Welcome to Catholic Answers Live, hour two of 2 hours today on apologetics and evangelization, as you have come to know and love. I am David Matheson. I'm the fundraising director here at Catholic Answers, and I have the privilege of sitting in for Cy Kellett, who is actually traveling with Tim Staples in Utah today. They are giving a couple of parish talks up that way, and I get the chance to sit in with not only you, the listeners today, but here in the second hour, I get to sit in with Jimmy Akin, our own Jimmy Akin. Jimmy, welcome.
Oh, glad to be here. Welcome to you.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it. We have an open forum this hour. The number to call is 888-318-7884. Again, that is 888-31-TRUTH. The lines are filling up. If you'd like to get your question in this hour, I'd encourage you to call as soon as possible. And if you get a busy signal, call right back and we'll try to get you on the list. So, Jimmy, you are, of course, the author of The Bible is a Catholic Book. You have also written a number of different 20 Answers series brochures or booklets for us. One of the most recent is the Book of Revelation. I believe you've got another 20 Answers coming out soon that you're working on
yes.
right now.
No, I finished it.
It's done.
I turned it in a few weeks ago. The new one
Great.
Is going to be on 20 Answers, the Gospels.
There you go.
And so I'm going to be talking about the four Gospels, how each of them is distinctive, who wrote them, when they were written, why we should trust them rather than apocryphal Gospels. Do we know anything about Jesus outside the Gospels and stuff like that? But I turned that in a few weeks ago. It only took me 8 business days to write it around my other duties. So it was went pretty quick.
Indeed. And in fact, that ties right in. You are fresh off what I thought was a fantastic debate with Bart Ehrman here at a local parish on the reliability of the Gospels. And I only mention it not only because you did such a great job, but also if you missed that debate of Jimmy and Dr. Ehrman, it is posted on YouTube. So you can go back and revisit that that debate. Again, if you just go to the Catholic Answers YouTube channel and search for Jimmy Akin, Bart Ehrman, you will find that. Since that debate, Jimmy, any additional thoughts? You have any other debates coming up?
Well, I did a debrief or two on the Bart Ehrman debate, and if people go to youtube.com/JimmyAkin, which is my YouTube channel, they can watch the debate there. They can also watch a debrief I did afterwards. Recently, Bart posted the video as well on one of his channels, and he did a blog post about it in which he conceded that I was a really nice guy, and so that was nice because I was deliberately trying to be really nice with Bart, and that message seemed to have come across.
Indeed,
have subsequently done a debate or two since then. But if people are interested, they can go to youtube.com/JimmyAkin, and I have a playlist of my debates and debriefs.
Very good, very good. Well, Jimmy, we've got a full list of callers up here. How about we get right to it?
Sure.
Okay, great. Why don't we go to, Blake in Nebraska. Blake is on line one. He is watching on YouTube. Blake, what is your question for Jimmy?
Hi, Jimmy. So I've heard that in the early church, the sacrament of reconciliation was to the whole congregation. And it was mainly just for like the major mortal sins, like adultery, murder, apostasy. I was wondering, did they confess almost like lesser mortal sins, like missing mass, masturbation, other things like that in front of the entire congregation? Or was that done separately or like just to the priest like now, or something completely different?
So the evidence we have about the earliest forms in the earliest ways in which confession was celebrated is rather spotty because, you know, we're talking about the first century, and almost all of the literature we have from that period is found within the New Testament. And we do have indications in the New Testament that there were communal confessions. The New Testament in the epistles says, confess your sins one to another, and that suggests a kind of group confession. However, at the same time, we see evidence that the presbyters or priests were involved in this. In James chapter 5, for example, James associates the forgiveness of sins with the ministrations of the presbyters or priests. And ultimately, it was realized that you don't need to do this in front of other people other than the priest. It's really the priest as Christ's minister that has the ability to do this. And so the communal aspect is not essential to the sacrament. It was something that apparently was done in the early church, and not just in the first century, but for the first few centuries. However, eventually, it was discovered, big surprise, people will more readily confess if they don't have to do it in public. And so as a result, the practice of just privately confessing to a priest became common. And the role of the Irish was particularly notable in that regard. The idea of private confession was popularized in part through Irish Catholic culture, although it was there even earlier. We have references from early non-Irish individuals like Jerome and so forth who talk about private confession to a priest. So it clearly was being done. It just wasn't originally necessarily the normal mode the way it is today. In terms of what was confessed, well, we do have records of people confessing major things like abortion and adultery and lapsing into paganism and things like that. But there was kind of a learning curve, if I can put it that way, on the part of the church as the Holy Spirit led the church in doctrinal development. And over the course of time, there came to be a greater understanding of exactly what counts as a mortal sin and what did not. In principle, any sin that was recognized as spiritually killing your soul, yeah, that's what a mortal sin is. You lose the spiritual life that God has given your soul, which we know is sanctifying grace. Anything that you lose sanctifying grace, anything that calls your soul to spiritually die is a mortal sin, and that would have been confessed. What happened over time, though, is the Holy Spirit led the church into a greater appreciation of the exact boundaries of mortal sin and what the conditions are that need to be fulfilled in order for something to count as a mortal sin. And so in terms of like confessing lesser or greater mortal sins, well, I don't think they thought about it in those terms. They would have confessed anything that they recognized as a mortal sin. In an individual case, a sin might be lesser enough that it might not have been perceived as a mortal sin in some communities or by certain individuals, just like today. Individuals who don't recognize that something they're doing is gravely sinful and therefore it's not a mortal sin for them because they lack adequate knowledge of its moral character, well, they wouldn't confess that. And the same would have been true in the early church. But in principle, anything that was recognized as a mortal sin would have been confessed.
Very good, Blake. I hope that was helpful to you. We have got a full slate of callers here, so we're going to continue to move on, and we've also got a break coming up, so we're going to step away for just for a moment. Great start to a full hour of Open Forum with Jimmy Akin. The number to call is 888-318-7884, 888-31-TRUTH. We will be back right after this.
Let us help you with your question today on Catholic Answers Live.
Do you have a question but prefer to ask it privately? Catholic Questions can help. Go to CatholicQuestions.com to ask your question online, email us, drop us a letter, or give us a call. Longtime Catholic Answers Live apologist and author Jim Blackburn or another Catholic Questions apologist will be happy to assist you. Catholic Questions proudly supports Catholic Answers Live, so visit us at CatholicQuestions.com today. That's CatholicQuestions.com.
Thank you for all the work that you've done. I work at it and then it's like, you know, I stop and then I start and then I stop. You've done so much and thank you for everything you do. And thank you, EWTN. I mean, I had a line that I could spread at work today from what I heard this morning on EWTN, that it took a woman to put Jesus on the earth.
EWTN, helping people grow in their love and understanding of God.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. David Matheson sitting in for Cy Kellett today, and we are in the middle of an open forum with our own Jimmy Akin. The number to call is 888-318-7884. Before we get back to calls, I do want to remind folks that the National Conference, the Catholic Answers National Conference, is returning this September, the 22nd through the 25th in La Jolla, California, which is right outside beautiful and sunny San Diego. The theme for this year's National Conference is the Eucharist. I am with you always. We have some special guest speakers, including Bishop Thomas Papraki of Springfield, Illinois. But of course, we also have our own Catholic Answer speakers led by Jimmy Akin. We'll have Tim Staples, Trent Horn, Carlo, Joe, Cy, and Christopher Check, our president. Simone Riscala of Endow will be there, as well as Dr. Lawrence Feingold. It is a fantastic 4 days of fun, 4 days of education, 4 days of apologetics and evangelization, and we will also be broadcasting live the Catholic Answers Live radio show with Cy Kellett from the conference as well. Right now, if you go to CatholicAnswersConference.com, you can buy your tickets, CatholicAnswersConference.com, and if you use the promo code EARLY, and this is not a permanent thing, this will end soon, if you enter the promo code EARLY, you will get $50 off each ticket. A full conference ticket includes not only all of the talks, but the banquet dinner with the keynote address by Bishop Papraki. And finally, if you stay there at the Hyatt Regency, we'll get you, for right now, we'll get you a special room rate of $169 per night. All the details, go to CatholicAnswersConference.com. That's where you can register and buy your tickets. Let's get right back to calls. Well, again, we've got a full slate of callers up here. Let's go to Aaron in line two. Aaron is calling from Rhode Island, and he is listening on the Catholic Answers Live app. Aaron, go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Hi. I just want to say thank you for answering my call.
You bet.
So I was wondering how I can... So in Matthew 16, it says, whoever wants to be a disciple of mine, take up your cross and follow me. I have a bunch of secular friends. Practically none of them believe in God. So I was wondering, throughout my day, how can I still honor God, but I go to school with them, and I don't, you know what I'm trying to say? It's like, how do I still honor God?
It's a great question,
even
Aaron.
Though yeah. Living with a bunch of secular people.
Well, make time for God. So, you know, even if you're not doing it in front of them, you can quietly say a prayer to God at different points during the day. Set aside time for personal, you know, Bible reading or reading the catechism or doing a devotion of some kind. It's really up to you. I mean, the things that that you want to do are things that you make time for. And so if you want to maintain a focus on God, which is a good thing, then set aside time for God. It doesn't have to be a big chunk of time. It may be little chunks of time during the day. And just make an effort to do those things. You don't have to like promise every single day I'm going to do this, but you know, make a regular habit and think in terms of, as you go through the day, think in terms of how would I regard this from a Christian point of view. You know, you want a kind of process running in your head all the time, keeping the faith relevant to your experiences. You don't want to just forget about the faith completely. It doesn't mean you have to think about God all the time. God doesn't expect that of us. He expects us to direct our attention to other things we need to deal with in this life. But you do want a kind of general frame of reference where you are regularly thinking about God and thinking about your experiences through a Christian lens. And ideally, you know, at opportune moments, you want to even talk to your friends about God. But that does, like I said, that doesn't mean every moment, but it's something you don't want to hide the fact you're a Christian either. And so, you know, look for opportunities where they may be open to hearing about something from the Christian perspective.
What do you think about that, Aaron?
Thank you.
You bet. Thanks for calling in.
I think that's really helpful.
Great.
Good.
God bless you. Okay, let's go to line three, Chad. Chad is watching on YouTube from Colorado Springs, Colorado. Chad, what's your question for Jimmy?
Hi, thanks for taking my call. My question is about Micah 5. As you know, this is the chapter that predicts the Messiah's birth in Bethlehem. Mm-hmm. And just a couple of verses after that, it says, of this figure who will be born in Bethlehem, it says, he will be our peace when the Assyrians invade our land and march through our fortresses. We will raise against them seven shepherds, even eight commanders who will rule the land of Assyria with a sword, the land of Nimrod with a drawn sword. He will deliver us from the Assyrians when they invade our land and march across our borders. So my question is this something that Jesus did? Did he fulfill this role? And if not, is this something that will be fulfilled in the future?
Well, it's hard to say whether there will be a fulfillment of this in the future. Of course, that's possible. But the way Christians have traditionally looked at this is to see this as something that has been fulfilled through Christ, although prophecy is not always fulfilled in the way people expect. One of the things that Jesus made clear was that his kingdom is not of this world. He said, if it were, then my followers would take up swords and defend him and so forth. And he indicated that's not what his kingdom is about. So even though there were passages that could be read in a way that would expect a kind of political military Messiah, that would be a political military leader, Jesus indicated, no, really, he's going to bring about his kingdom in a spiritual way rather than a political military way through the advance of the gospel. And so a standard way in Christian history of understanding this passage in Micah would be to say, well, he did that in keeping with his own terms, he was going to advance his kingdom spiritually and conquer people spiritually through the gospel. And that's what happened. In fact, that's what happened with the Assyrians. At one point in time, the Assyrians were politically and militarily opposed to God's people, Israel, but after the time of Christ, they converted. They became Christians. In fact, the Assyrian Church of the East today is explicitly Christian, and other people from the Assyrian region, including Chaldeans and so forth, and Syrians, they became Christians. And so the gospel did triumph over them, and that can be seen as the way in which this prophecy was fulfilled.
Okay.
Chad, what do you think?
I guess what concerns me a little bit is that it seems to me that for a prediction to have evidential value, it needs to be comprehensible or understandable prior to its fulfillment. Like, it sort of seems like what's happening is that there's a tendency to kind of reinterpret these prophecies in such a way as to make it fit a preconceived conclusion, which is that Jesus is the Messiah. Is there any truth to that? That maybe that's what's going on? I mean, I highly doubt. Would you agree that if you were living prior to Jesus, you would probably understand this prophecy differently?
Yes, I would say prior to the time of Jesus, I would understand the prophecy differently because he hadn't yet come and made clear how he planned his kingdom to work. So I wouldn't appeal to this particular passage as providing. The bit about Assyria, I wouldn't appeal to that as providing proof that Jesus is the Messiah. There's a difference in science between what's sometimes called proof-oriented research and process-oriented research. In proof-oriented research, what you're trying to do is provide evidence or proof that something is true. In process-oriented research, you're no longer trying to prove how something works. You're trying to understand the process by which it works. And so when it comes to messianic prophecies, I wouldn't appeal to what Micah says about the Assyrians as proof Jesus is the Messiah. I would appeal to other passages that contain clearer messianic prophecies as evidence or proof that Jesus is the Messiah. But then having understood that Jesus is the Messiah, having discerned that truth, I would then say, okay, so what can we learn about Jesus from a process-oriented perspective? How does his messiahship work? And at that point, the gospel evidence comes in that he did not intend to be a political military leader. Instead, he intended to be a spiritual leader, and therefore, We need to understand passages that make him sound as if he were a military leader in spiritual terms instead. So I would say we need to be willing to shift from a proof-oriented perspective to a process-oriented perspective. How does his messiahship work? And thus, some passages may be appropriate to appeal to when trying to prove that Jesus is the Messiah, and other passages may need to be understood in terms of what has he revealed about how his messiahship works.
Thank you, Chad. We appreciate your call today. We're going to keep on moving here with the full slate of callers waiting here to ask questions of Jimmy Akin. In fact, we're going to go to line 5, an anonymous caller from West Virginia watching on YouTube. Anonymous, ask your question of Jimmy Akin.
Hi, Jimmy. I'm a social work major, and I'm about to enter into my internship. And my internship is with families where I'm going to be helping fathers reunite with their family. And I was just wondering how I should approach that if, say, the father is not married to the mother, and the goal is basically me trying to get them to live with each other again. I don't know how I should approach that with that possibility in mind.
Well, I don't know the constraints you're operating under in your program, but there is a good to having both, I mean, under ordinary circumstances, there is a big benefit to having both parents involved in the lives of their children. Children who grow up with only one parent have, as I'm sure you know from your coursework, have markedly less successful life outcomes than children who grow up with both parents involved. And so there is a good there. At the same time, there is an evil if the parents are living together and sleeping together and are not married to each other. So so what has to happen is a kind of weighing of the comparative goods. Now, ultimately, these parents are adults, and you are not responsible for the choices they make. What you can do is encourage them to make better choices, and a better choice than having the father completely uninvolved in the children's lives would be to have the father involved. And another better outcome would be for the father to marry the mother and commit to each other. And I mean, under ordinary circumstances, would be to have the father commit to the mother and get married and raise the children in a family. And so to the extent your program permits you, I would encourage them to do that as well, to talk about the benefits of marriage and how it can help them and how it can help the children and so forth.
Anonymous, I hope that was a good answer for you. We'll certainly keep you in our prayers, and we're going to keep on moving here. Let's go to Nicole in South Carolina. Nicole is listening on the Catholic Answers Live app. And Nicole, if we can't get fully through Jimmy's answer here, we'll pick it up on the other side of the break, because we do have a break coming up. But Nicole, go ahead and ask your question of Jimmy. Nicole, are you there? Go ahead.
Yeah, can you hear me?
Yes, we can now. Go ahead.
Okay. I'm not exactly sure how to phrase this question, but recently I've been interested in, like, techniques for interpretation of the Bible, and I've been really interested in typology, and I was just wondering your perspective on, like, the utility of that
for
interpretation of...
Okay, so I should probably start by clarifying what typology is, because it's a term that not everybody is familiar with. Basically, one of the things that's been noted for a long time is that in addition to the meanings that you would come up with just based on a straightforward reading of a biblical text, particularly in the Old Testament, you also see what look like kind of foreshadowing of things that will happen in the New Testament. For example, in the Old Testament, in one passage, the prophet is saying, on behalf of God, out of Israel or out of Egypt, I called my son. And it's clear from the context, on the literal reading, the straightforward reading of that text, the prophet is talking about Israel, the whole nation, as God's son. And yet, when Christ the Messiah came, he also spent time in Egypt, and he was then called back from Egypt after Herod the Great died. And Matthew, the evangelist, picks up on this. He knows the Old Testament statement about Israel being called out of Egypt as God's son. And then he sees, wow, when Jesus comes and he's God's son, he also gets called out of Egypt. And so Matthew points out that one of the fulfillments of this prophecy was Christ's and the Holy Family's flight to Egypt and then their return from it. And so what happened with Israel as a nation when they went to Israel and came back was what's called a type of what happened with Jesus. Jesus is the anti-type of the original type, because they both went to Egypt and both came back, and Israel's experience foreshadows Jesus. So that's kind of a brief look at typology, but in terms of how we can use it, we'll discuss that on the other side of the break.
Very good, Nicole. Stay with us. Jimmy's going to pick it back up, as he said, on the other side of the break. We'll be back in just a little bit. You're on Catholic Answers Live, open forum with Jimmy Akin, 888-318-7884.
Have you enrolled in the Catholic Answers School of Apologetics? Let me ask you a more important question. Do you believe as a Catholic that you have an obligation to share the Catholic faith? In fact, the Church has answered this question, and the answer is that all confirmed Catholics are obliged to share the faith. It's actually in canon law. Catholic Answers is here to help you fulfill that obligation. Our School of Apologetics courses will equip you to help all the people you come in contact with understand what the Church teaches and why. A great place to start is with all the Catholics in your life. Learn the art of apologetics from the best of the best and start sharing the gospel today. Visit schoolofapologetics.com. That's schoolofapologetics.com. Here's a question. Is it really possible to be friends with someone who died 2,000 years ago? Maybe the problem is that we've grown way too comfortable with the story of Jesus. Nice man, right? Taught us to love one another, said not to judge people. We celebrate his birthday every year. It's time to put away this small, safe version of Jesus, says Cy Kellett. Nobody that bland could have transformed the world. In A Teacher of Strange Things, Cy presents Jesus Christ undiluted by sentiment, with all his radical words and deeds uncensored. Do you know someone, your son or daughter perhaps, or maybe your mom or dad, who needs the friendship of Jesus Christ? Do you? Order your copy of A Teacher of Strange Things by visiting shop.catholic.com today or asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Did you know you can access Catholic Answers Live right from your phone or other mobile device? Download the Catholic Answers Live app today. The Catholic Answers Live app, available now on iOS and Android.
Hi, this is Janet Williams. You don't have to be a woman to enjoy Women of Grace tomorrow at 11 a.m. Eastern here on EWTN Radio. Now, back to Catholic Answers Live.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. David Matheson sitting in for Cy Kellett today. We are, as we typically are on Thursday, we are in the midst of a 1 hour of open forum with our own Jimmy Akin. The number to call is 888-318-7884. And Jimmy, you were in the middle of talking to Nicole about typology, so I'll let you continue that answer.
Yeah, so a type is something typically in the Old Testament that foreshadows something later on, typically in the New Testament. And the thing that a type foreshadows is known as its anti-type. Now, over the course of time, the Church has had it, and Catholic thinkers have had a chance to reflect on the role of typology. And if you look in the Catechism of the Catholic Church, it has a brief summary of, this is in the section on Scripture, so it's very early in the Catechism where it's talking about the sources of faith. But it has a very brief discussion of how to interpret Scripture. And one of the things it points out is a principle that goes all the way back to the beginning of church history, which is that we need to first discern what the literal sense of a text is before we start looking for additional meanings. So you want to understand the literal sense first. And what the literal sense is, that doesn't mean what you would think if you took everything woodenly literally. Like, for example, if Jesus is telling a parable and he says there was this father who had two sons and one of the sons went off and lived a life of sin and then came back, you know, he's telling the parable of the prodigal son. It would be the wrong question to say, oh, what were their names? You know, because Jesus is not talking about a real family here. He's using a literary device of a parable to teach a spiritual lesson. And what the literal sense of the text is not that there was literally a family like this. The literal sense is the sense that's intended by the sacred author. And so when Luke is recording the parable of the prodigal son, Luke is intending to preserve the spirit, the teaching of Jesus, and thus the spiritual message about forgiveness that Jesus was teaching. So the literal sense of the parable of the prodigal son is not about a specific family that lived somewhere. It's about the spiritual message of forgiveness. And so what you need to do in interpreting scripture is figure out what the original author's intent was, what he was trying to communicate, taking into account the fact that the human author may use figures of speech and parables and all symbols and all kinds of things like that. But once you've figured that out, you've got the literal sense. After you've done that, you can then look for additional senses. And these additional senses, if they're genuinely there, are things that were intended by God, the divine author, even though the human author may not have been aware of them. For example, the Old Testament prophet who said about Israel, out of Egypt I called my son, he probably didn't know that the future Messiah was going to be in a similar situation where the Messiah would have to go to Egypt and then come back. What he was aware of was the nation of Israel had done this, but God was aware of this additional application of the prophecy. And so when we're exploring additional meanings, what we're trying to discern are not what the human author understood, but what God would have understood. And we see biblical authors doing this. Like if you look in St. Paul's letter to the Galatians, he has a passage where he talks about the modern Jerusalem and the new Jerusalem that Christians belong to as reflecting Abraham's wives Sarah and Hagar. You know, if you read Genesis where we hear about Sarah and Hagar, you wouldn't suspect that in the literal sense, certainly there's nothing there about the city of Jerusalem or New Jerusalem. This is an additional spiritual meaning that God was aware of and that St. Paul picks up on, but it's not part of what the original author was intending. In terms of how to discern types, well, what you need to do after you figured out the literal sense of the text is think about, well, to what degree is this text similar to something else I know about, particularly something in the New Testament? And to the extent that it's similar, like going to Egypt and coming back, if you're God's son, it serves as a valid type. So you can identify types by thinking about the similarities and the degree to which a passage in the Old Testament is similar to some concept from the New Testament. But there's also an important caution here. This is a principle St. Thomas Aquinas talks about, we don't want to appeal to spiritual meanings or typological meanings when we are trying to prove something, because what spiritual meaning a text may contain is not as obvious or certain as its literal sense. And so St. Thomas Aquinas would say, like, if you're in an apologetic argument with someone, you don't want to grab some spiritual meaning and say, this proves what I'm trying to say, because your interlocutor, the person you're talking with, we'll just say, well, I don't see that at all. This is just a meaning you're seeing in this text, but it's not what the human author intended. And he would be right that the human author didn't intend it. The problem is, how do you prove God intended it? And so for apologetic purposes, that's really hard to do. And so for apologetic purposes, we should stick to trying to prove things with the literal sense of the text. But then once we make that shift to process-oriented thinking and we are understanding the process of how of God's whole plan and how it all fits together, that's where it becomes reasonable to start looking beyond the literal sense to these additional meanings.
Nicole, thanks for your call today. We appreciate it. We're going to keep moving here and go to John on line 6. John is calling from Cincinnati, Ohio, listening on 740 AM. John, go ahead with your question.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. It's an honor to talk to Jimmy and the team.
Thank you.
You bet.
I have a hypothetical question, kind of debating in my own mind, but
what is it?
So I'm Catholic, I'm baptized, confirmed, had the Eucharist. I have no mortal sin that I'm aware of. And I'm able to go into a time machine back to the time of Moses. I am able to approach the Jewish people in the desert. They have the Ark of the Covenant. And I walk up, somehow I'm able to get to it. I walk up to it, I grab it. I maybe even open it up and look in there. Am I able to survive that?
Well, I wouldn't recommend you doing that because Jewish people regarded the Ark of the Covenant as extremely holy, and only the high priest was allowed to directly interact with it. And so they would probably kill you if you tried to do that. So you probably would not survive. However, I suspect what you may be thinking of is an incident that occurred later than the desert experience in the history of Israel, where during David's time, they were transporting the Ark of the Covenant on an ox cart, and the oxen stumbled, and one of the attendants, a guy named Uzzah, reached out his hand to steady the Ark, and he was struck dead. And so you may be wondering, well, like, would I be struck dead by God as opposed to the angry Israelites if I tried to touch the Ark? And the answer is we don't know for sure. I mean, obviously, some people had to be able to touch the Ark. The craftsman who built it had to touch the Ark, and the people who, presumably the high priest, who deposited things inside the ark, like the Ten Commandments and Aaron's rod and a pot of manna, you know, they had to touch the ark in order to put the things in it. So merely touching the ark was not an automatic death sentence. So why would Uzzah get struck dead when he touched the ark? Well, one thing you find out when you read what the Old Testament has to say about transporting the ark is that you weren't supposed to put it on an ox cart. It had these rings on it, and you were supposed to have poles, and you would put the poles through the rings, and then a group of Levites would hoist up the poles on their shoulders and carry the ark that way. And so by transporting the ark in this unauthorized way of putting it on an ox cart, they were breaking God's explicit instructions about it. And so that may be why Uzzah didn't survive when he touched the ark, because they were transporting the ark in an illegitimate, forbidden way, and he was facilitating that process. And so can't say for sure which category you would fall in if you touched the ark. It could be that you would fall in the category of the craftsmen or the high priests that were able to touch it without being struck dead. Or it could be that God would say, nah, this guy's acting more like Uzzah. So that's really up to God to decide.
John, thank you for your call today. I appreciate it. We all appreciate it. And thanks for listening. Before we go to a break here in just a couple of moments, I want to remind everyone that if you would like to connect more deeply with the apostolate here at Catholic Answers, with our ministry, become a greater part of what we do. One of the great ways to do that is by joining Society 315. So Society 315 is our monthly giving club. For just $10 a month, you get a Society t-shirt, you get a car magnet, you get a permanent 20% discount on all of the products that you buy from our online shop. In addition, this is a great time to join because for Society members only, on June the 8th, we have a webinar coming up with our own Cy Kellett and Trent Horn talking about the repeal of Roe versus Wade and the potential consequences. You know, what's next after, if in fact it is repealed by the Supreme Court, what's next for the pro-life movement? So if you'd like to join in on that webinar, The way to do it, the only way to do it, is to be or become a member of Society 315. Go to CASociety315.com, CASociety315.com, and commit to a $10 a month donation or more, and you will get further communications on us on how to fully activate your membership, including an invitation to that upcoming webinar on June 8th. More open forum with Jimmy Akin coming up. Jennifer, Marie, Thomas, and Joel are on the board. We're going to try to get to all four of you before we're finished today, but we're going to take a quick break. We'll be back right after this.
Hang on. Catholic Answers Live will return in a moment.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects homebuyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
Go forth and preach the good news. It's not just a suggestion. If you want to take more seriously the command of Jesus to share the gospel with those around you, consider joining St. Paul Street Evangelization. It's a grassroots organization that brings the Catholic faith to the streets in a non-confrontational way. Visit our website, www.streetevangelization.com, to learn more. And don't forget to like us on Facebook. It's time to do our part.
Divine Intimacy Radio.
The greatest joy in my life is helping others to come to know Christ more fully. And there's no better light on this path, the path to deep union with God, than the wisdom of the saints. Talking about this daily on EWTN Radio is one of the great joys of my life.
Divine Intimacy Radio, Sunday, 6:30 a.m., 1:30 p.m., and 11 p.m. Eastern on EWTN Radio.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. David Matheson sitting in for Cy Kellett today and Jimmy Akin. We are in the midst of an open forum with Jimmy, and we're going to go right back to the lines. Let's go to line one. Jennifer in Canada watching on YouTube. Jennifer, ask your question, please, of Jimmy.
Hi, Jimmy. Thank you for taking my call. I had a discussion with my sister, who is a non-denominational Protestant, about the necessity of baptism. I mentioned to her that she had never been baptized, and she said that she had, but in the spirit when she became a Christian. Basically, the discussion surrounded the requirement of water for baptism, and I had mentioned the scripture verse John 3:5, and she said that being born of the water in this verse was referring to amniotic fluid and describing childbirth, and that what was important in this verse was being born of the Spirit, and that's the only requirement for baptism, so no need for water with a baptism. I believe her interpretation of the verse is incorrect. She maintains that this verse proves her point. I don't know how to explain that the water in the verse from John 3:5 is not referring to childbirth and why water is necessary for a baptism. So I was wondering if you could explain it.
So the first problem is that, and I, this is a view that I've known about for a long time. I was taught this back before I was Catholic, so I used to hold this view. And I, as I did more study, I realized that there were problems with this view. And some of the problems include the following. The first one is that it is exceptionally hard to find references in which ancient Greek authors use the word for water, hudor, to refer to amniotic fluid. This is not a standard usage. If you look up the word hudor in a Greek lexicon or Greek dictionary, amniotic fluid will not be listed, not in any standard one, certainly. And that's because we just don't have a lot of references to Greeks using the term this way. Another problem is not obvious in English, but the Greek grammar is such that it at least suggests the that this is a unitary event, that it's a birth of water and spirit. It's not two separate births. And one of the things that points in that direction is the presence of a pronoun that is in front of the phrase in Greek, water and the spirit. The pronoun is ek, and there are other ways in Greek that you could simply say of water and of the spirit. And the presence of the pronoun is something that that points us in the direction of this is a single event. This is a birth of both water and spirit, not two separate births. Also, there is, so Jesus in John 3:5 tells Nicodemus that you have to be born of water and spirit. And when Nicodemus questions that, Jesus responds in verse 10 by saying, "Are you a teacher of Israel, and yet you do not understand this?" So it's like he expects Nicodemus to already be familiar with something from Jewish teaching that would lead him to expect a birth of water and spirit. And if you go back into the Old Testament, there's really one notable passage that talks about God applying water and affecting our spirits. It's in Ezekiel, where there is a prophecy about one day God is going to wash us with clean water, and he's going to change our hearts, or he's going to sprinkle us with clean water, and he's going to, or which is a form of washing, and he's going to give us new hearts, and it's going to affect a change in our spirits. And he, you know, he's doing this, of course, by his Holy Spirit. And so it sounds like that passage is what Jesus has in mind, that that's what he's expecting Nicodemus to be familiar with. And that passage involves the application of water. And so that would seem to be background that involves water, but it doesn't all rest on just this passage. You have other passages in the New Testament that clearly refer to us receiving new life or regeneration or new birth in connection with baptism. If you look in Romans, for example, Paul talks about us rising to new life as a result of our baptism. And your sister might say, well, this is spirit baptism, or this is some kind of spiritual baptism. But at that point, the burden of proof is on her. We've already seen that John 3:5 does not prove her point. There are other ways of taking it that have support, like the supports I just mentioned. So we know that baptism, at least the way the term is normally used, involves water, because we see that all over the place. I mean, we see that in the Gospels, that baptism involves water. We see that in the book of Acts. We even see that in the epistles. And so we have a bunch of documentation that for water involving baptism, but we don't have good evidence for the alternative, for a kind of purely spiritual baptism that does not involve water. So the burden of proof, I think, is on your sister on that point. Then, especially if she's trying to convince you that baptism does not need to involve water, then we have 1 Peter 3:21. And in 1 Peter 3:21, Peter is explicitly talking about water. He's drawing a comparison to what happened in Noah's flood, in which he says eight people were saved through water. And then he says, in the same way, baptism now saves you. And so he has just put water and baptism on the table together and said that saves you, which is a description of the new birth or regeneration or salvation or whichever one of these terms you want to use. Finally, there is historical evidence in the form of the church fathers. So many of them were Greek speakers, and all of them were closer in time and culture to the New Testament than we are. And if you go through the writings of the church fathers, you will not find any of them interpreting John 3:5 in this way. I once did a study, this was years ago, back around the time I became Catholic, where I did electronic searches of huge, enormous, this 38-volume set of the Church Fathers, and I looked up all the references to John 3:5, and none of them said that it's amniotic fluid. So if her amniotic fluid hypothesis was correct, why didn't anybody in the early church say that? And why do all of the authors in the early church say, no, that's baptism, if they address the question?
Jennifer, thanks for your call today. We appreciate that. I hope that answer was useful. Let's go ahead and go to Marie in Seattle, Washington. Marie is listening on Sacred Heart Radio. Go ahead with your question, Marie.
Oh, hi.
Hello.
Hi, what's your question?
Yes, I am at the store right now, but then I will tell you one thing. Yeah, so...
Okay, Marie, we're running out of time, and I want to give you the best answer I can, so I need you to ask me the question.
Yes. Let me go out and here. You know what? I say that the way I feel is that people give birth to children because they were young, and that's the instinct, you know. So, but then if they delay until like older and then they still have the chance to give birth, I think they might choose not to give birth at all. Do you feel like that?
So if I understand your question, is it better not to have children because of how bad the world is? And I would say, no, it is not good to avoid children because of the state of the world for a couple of reasons. One reason is that that the state of the world, although it is worse in some ways than it used to be, in many other ways, we're living in the best time in history. The idea that the past was golden and it was much superior to the present is actually not true. A book that discusses that you might want to check out is by Steven Pinker. It's called The Better Angels of Our Nature. And he's not even a Christian, but looking at various indicators like your chances of dying a violent death, we're living in a much better time than at any point in history. Similarly, people have much more freedom today than they have at any point in history. Now, that has brought with it some problems with people abusing their freedom, but on balance, we're actually in a pretty good place in human history. But there are some big problems we do need to look out for, like and address, like abortion. In terms of the second reason, existing is a good thing. It's better to exist than not to exist, and everything is in God's hands anyway. He can guide and protect people in the world. He can lead them to Him, and He can give them a glorious eternity where they have infinite beatitude, infinite happiness for all eternity. And whatever evils you may have had to deal with when you were in the world, it's better to exist and have the opportunity to experience God's presence for all eternity than not to exist. And so I don't think people should avoid having children at all because of problems in the world today. I think we should trust God. I think we should have, you know, the children we can reasonably handle, and then we should trust God to guide us and guide our children to Him over the course of their lives.
Thank you, Marie. We're going to move on. Thomas, we're going to take your question. Thomas calling from St. Paul, watching on YouTube. Hey, Thomas, ask your question really quickly, and Jimmy will see if we can get you a good answer, okay? Go ahead, Thomas.
All right, thank you. So, in short, Jesus came in His passion, death, and resurrection to free us from original sin, but still afterwards were affected by the effects of original sin. So, in short, if Jesus came to free us from original sin, and its effects, why are we still dealing with things like pain, sickness, death after, or even after receiving sanctifying grace?
So the basic answer is God has chosen to use processes. This applies in many different aspects of His creation. We can't say for sure why God chose to use a process in a particular case rather than doing something instantly, but we can see that He has clearly made that choice because there's a process to how plants grow. They don't just appear fully formed. There's a process to how humans grow. They don't just appear fully formed. God uses processes for things. And among the things that we can tell from the fact we do still experience suffering is that He chose to use a process in how He applies what Christ did for us. So we don't expect it all at once, but God will lead us to a state where we don't have pain and suffering anymore. And St. Paul says that the sufferings of this life are not worth comparing to what God has in store for us. So we need to recognize that God uses processes, including with respect to salvation, and trust Him and look forward to what He has in store for us.
Very good. I hope that answer was good for you, Thomas. Joel, I'm sorry we didn't get to you today. We can take you call back in tomorrow. We can put you top of the line. Jimmy, thanks for another great hour. We appreciate it. Look forward to seeing you again soon here on Catholic Answers Live. Two more hours tomorrow, 6 to 8 p.m. Eastern. Listen in. We'll see you then. God bless.